This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, November 11th, 2012, Veterans Day. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from To Enjoy Magazine, a monthly publication offering local arts, culture, and entertainment. The second annual Crystal Bridges Museum commemorative issue is now available. To Enjoy thanks everyone for their positive response over the past 3 years. Subscriptions and more information available by calling 464-8900 or numeral 2, letter N, joymag.com.
Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, celebrating a historic mountain in Madison County and the Great American Smokeout.
But first, if titles like Space Invaders, Atari, and Gunfight bring up memories for you, then you may be excited to hear about a new business in Evelyn Hills, one where video games line the walls. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has a preview.
Although coin-operated video games are not as prevalent as they were before the rise in popularity of the home video game console, vintage video game fanatics in Fayetteville will soon have a new haven in which to while away countless hours blasting at asteroids, jumping over barrels, and toppling turtles. That's one of the reasons why Fayetteville resident Shay Mathis decided to open Arcadia Retrocade, a new arcade with more than 50 vintage arcade games set to open in the coming days at the Evelyn Hills Shopping Center in Midtown Fayetteville.
What we're hoping to do is sort of create a little pocket alternate universe here, where when you walk through the front door of the Arcadia Retrocade, you're kind of like walking into an alternate universe where there was an arcade from 1982 that just never closed. There's something that one can experience when you're playing a video game, or it's kind of akin, and no offense to our readers and my former AP Lit teachers and stuff, but it's something along the lines of when you get lost in a really good book. There's a similarity in the experience of getting lost in fantasy, of getting lost in the experience of playing one of these games and being in a place where you could just forget all of your troubles, forget all the stuff that's going on in the outside world, and just have fun like you did when you were 12.
But this arcade is a little bit different than many other arcades. One machine that will not be found within the arcade's walls is a change machine. Mathis says that no quarters are necessary to play in this arcade.
Once you pay to enter the arcade, you pay for nothing else unless you want to buy a Coke or something from the snack bar. All of the game machines, in other words, are free play.
In addition to the many stand-up arcade machines that will line the walls of the Arcadia Retrocade, a raised platform in the center of the room will provide seating for the arcade snack bar, a handful of cocktail table arcade games, and an area for a monthly featured classic video game console. Mathis says that he hopes to create the feel of an arcade that opened in 1982 and never closed, and that the machines in his arcade have the patina to match it.
I like the fact that the games show their wear a little bit. That shows the character, that's part of the character of each game, the history of each game. You know, we have an old Pong. It's actually a Pong knockoff cocktail table game that came out of an old pizza parlor in the 70s. It's fun to imagine the history behind each one of these games. We like some of the games showing a little bit of their wear so that when you play this thing, you know that it has been through the ringer. It has been possibly all over the country and back just to get here to you, to have you play it and enjoy it now 20 years after the last time you plunked a quarter into it.
Mathis says that the games in the arcade come from a variety of sources. Some games were found after long hours of scouring Craigslist, while others were bought at auctions that included arcade machines, jukeboxes, toy cranes, and other machines generally found in restaurants and at the entrance of box stores. The games cost between $200 and $300 a piece on average, and though they may look a little rough on the outside, Mathis says that most of the games needed little work to get them up and running.
Simple cleaning, dusting, so cleaning the contacts, and just double checking to make sure there weren't stuff that wasn't connected properly. So with very little experience, I managed to get three or four of the games up and running just as soon as we got them home and off the truck that were not actually working when we bought them. You need to have a little bit of know-how on the technical end, and fortunately, I've got some buddies who have have been playing around with this sort of thing for some time and have a little bit of experience and are also kind of learning as we go on some of the, certainly some of the older ones, you know. So yes, here and there you have to do a little soldering or a little this or a little that or a few magic tricks here and there.
And considering the age of the majority of games in the arcade, Mathis says that people shouldn't be surprised if they come in one day only to find that their favorite machine is out of order. The oldest game inside is more than 30 years old and is a verifiable classic.
This is Asteroids. Most people who were in arcades in the 80s will recognize Asteroids as one of the quote old school games, and this was made in 1979. It's a little faded, but it still plays as well as it did, you know, probably a year or two after it rolled off the factory floor.
Mathis says that Asteroids will occupy a special place in front of the arcade with all of the classic games, which will include other titles such as Pac-Man, Centipede, Donkey Kong, and the original Mario Brothers arcade game, which Mathis says he remembers playing as a child living in Fayetteville.
And this particular game, they used to have in one of the grocery stores here in town, and my friend and I were talking about it, trying to probe our memory banks to recall whether or not it was the IGA down on the corner of Lafayette and 71. And we're pretty sure, because when I would go spend the night and have a sleepover at his house, and you know, invariably his mom would need to pull over and get some groceries or something, and she'd give us each a quarter and say, "Have at it," and then she'd go grocery shop, and we'd sit there on one quarter apiece and just burn an otherwise boring 7.5 minutes up.
And childhood dreams are what Mathis says is responsible for fueling his desire to open an arcade.
This or something like this is the kind of project, the kind of sort of quote dream job that I and a lot of my buddies as kids would have said we would love to do. Oh man, we could own our own arcade one day. It's the kind of thing that, you know, sitting around talking with your friends when you're 12 or 15, or even when you're, you know, in those murky college years trying to figure out why you're majoring and what you chose to major in, that sort of thing. You invariably get to that point of the night where you're having that discussion. You know, I just wish we could open up our own comic book store. I wish we could run an old art house theater and just play awesome movies and blah, blah, blah. That sort of discussion. This is the kind of thing we as friends have talked about for years and years.
He says that the thought occurred to him to open an arcade at a time when he was unemployed. While he says he could have worked for somebody else relatively comfortably, he was unsure whether he would be able to live with himself had he not taken the chance on opening his own business. And opening a vintage arcade doesn't come without its setbacks. Mathis says that while he planned to open in the middle of October, construction delays caused him to push back the grand opening numerous times.
I'll give you a very good example. The bathrooms that we needed to install, we had 100% full bathroom remodel back in the back. And when the original building was built, this particular wing of the building, they did not plumb for sewer all the way across the length of the building. So the plumbing stopped at a little tiny rinky-dink little employee bathroom. And so we literally had to get in and bust up about 35 feet of concrete to lay a trunk line, a sewer line, set in the concrete. And so I would definitely call it a complication. It's not something that our guys couldn't handle. They did a great job, and that actually didn't take even as long as I thought that would, but that was certainly a complication.
And aside from construction, Mathis says that the process of opening an arcade isn't for the faint of heart.
It's been crazy. It's been absolutely nuts and fun and everything, all of that stuff that you can imagine. It has been that. Lots of sleep deprivation, lots of budgeting and rebudgeting and rebudgeting.
While he says he has been putting in long hours trying to get the arcade ready for its opening, Mathis says opening the arcade couldn't have been possible without the help from a handful of family, friends, and other people who have lent their services to making his arcade dreams come true. The Arcadia Retrocade is set to open this week. For more information, Mathis suggests that interested parties should seek out the arcade's page on Facebook. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
In Madison County, there's a place called Negro Mountain. It marks a remote area once inhabited by Ozarks African American settlers and their 20th century descendants. All of them are gone now, except for one individual. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Frohlich takes us to meet the last living African American in Madison County.
It doesn't appear on the paper state highway maps, but if you MapQuest East Central Madison County, you'll see a tiny little triangle identified as Negro Mountain. Located on Horton Creek Township, it was home to a little-known Ozarks Black community. Some were descended from enslaved African Americans who were first brought to Madison County in the 1830s. Their population grew to 300 by 1860, but after emancipation, half of them left. Families who stayed built homesteads, with most concentrated along Pigman Creek. Over the decades, their numbers dwindled to 124 in 1880, 44 in 1900, 15 by 1940. Today, only one descendant remains. All these records and much more are stored in the Madison County Historical Society in downtown Huntsville. And this afternoon, a special reunion is taking place to honor Madison County's historic Black population. Some white residents, like Wanda Evans, born in 1933, lived apart from the Blacks.
Their families lived on down farther down the creek. I'm sure my dad knew a lot more about them, but I just never did know them. And I was kind of afraid of them, you know, because I'd never seen colored people before. But they're just people like the rest of us.
Compared to other places in the South, she said, Black folk were accepted by Madison County white folk.
Pretty tolerant. Of course, there's intolerant people wherever you live. I think someone said that most people treated them pretty good, except there's one family or two that wasn't very nice to them. So,
but 80-year-old Vermalee Johnson Inman, who still lives on Horton Creek, had African-American neighbors.
I'd see them go by. Sometimes they'd stop and get a drink at the spring. My folks had a good spring there. And they'd talk, you know, and they'd go on home.
When she was little, Vermalee befriended an older Black girl.
We'd make mud pies, and the peach trees had bloomed. And the petals, the pink petals from the trees had fallen on the ground. So Artie said, let's put some of these pink petals on the pine. I thought that was the neatest thing I'd ever seen. just made that mud pie look so good.
The little girl was Artie Beatrice Cook, one of five children born to Haywood William Cook and Netsy Craven Cook. Now in her 90s, she still remembers those delicious-looking mud pies.
And put that on, like a coconut on top of a cake. you should knew that was going to be a cool thing.
The girls grew up exploring the countryside and playing in the creek. Vermalee's remained in Madison County while Artie moved to Fayetteville and married John Funkhauser.
Artie Beatrice Cook Funkhauser.
Artie's retired now, having worked for many years at the University of Arkansas cooking in the fraternity houses, and she gets around just fine with help of family and a cane, which she occasionally taps to make a point. She's fit, sharp, and filled with stories, including one of the old homestead spring.
Everlasting water. It sure was.
It never went dry.
I was going to ask you, was it dry?
I'm not. You mean the spring?
Mm-hmm.
I never was up there this year, already.
It never did go dry.
Madison County's Black children attended their own schools in the 1920s, Shady Grove and New Home. The Historical Society collections even holds a few of the Black children's report cards. Among them is one of Artie's, who earned lots of A's and B's. To help pay for school clothes, Artie took a job with a local white family.
The thing about it, there was no work. When the factory shut down, there was no work. Okay. I hired out as a family. They wrote in the paper and they wanted some girl, you know, for school clothing, you know. And so the name was Dudgeons. And I wrote them the letter back and told them I would stay with them. You know, I would stay, you know, in with them. Okay, I would cook. And, you know, do things like that and clean the house and do the laundering. And I did that and get money for my school clothing thing, see.
Eventually, all the Black schoolhouses closed for lack of students. By the mid-1940s, only one Black child remained in all of Madison County. And according to local history records, residents allowed the girl to enroll in an all-white school despite federally mandated segregation. No one objected. Some say the local school board and administrators kept it a secret from the State Board of Education. Artie says growing up in Madison County was like that. Everyone got along.
When we grew up, we could go to this show over here, and we could sit in the balcony, or we could sit downstairs. And this is the truth, okay? We could go into the stores over here in Huntsville, and we could try clothes on just like we doing now. And I mean, I didn't know any difference, honestly. And when I left and went to where I am now, I went in one time to try a dress on a Montgomery board. She said, oh, whoa, whoa, you can't try that on. I said, well, why? Well, you have to know your size. We don't allow people to try them on.
Well,
now, that is the God's truth. And I don't have many witnesses left to tell the truth. It's true.
So you grew up with a whole different experience.
I certainly did, but when I left, ooh, I said, what is this? Because I haven't been used to nothing like it.
Because where Artie was living then, in Fayetteville, like much of the South at the time, was strictly segregated. Mildred Stansel Jenkins, who is white, has deep roots in Madison County as far back as the early 19th century. And her family and the Cooks were close.
I knew the family and her aunt, like I say, was always at my grandmother's house because we called her Aunt Mex, but she didn't have any kids. My grandma had 7, and they lived just across the creek. And I don't think Aunt Mex had a sewing machine. So I remember my grandma used to sew for her, and she'd wash, help her wash. I mean, they just helped each other all the time. And I just grew up with her.
Mildred, who's moved away, reconnected with Artie after doing some family genealogy, and she's given Artie good perspective.
And so, I mean, you know, I've had a good life. I really have. Now I'm kind of crippled, but it's still good, and that I'm living.
You could be worse, couldn't you?
Now you can say that again.
On this beautiful warm autumn afternoon, Artie's being honored at a ceremony at Horton Creek Cemetery. A monument's been erected last January to commemorate Madison County's black community. Joy Russell, president of the Madison County Historical Society, oversaw the project.
We took donations for several years here at Decoration, and then the Historical Society has money that we allot each year, and we paid the rest of it.
The large gray marble monument dwarfs Horton Creek Cemetery's gravestones. Among the estimated 20 or so African Americans buried here are Artie's 2 grandmothers, 2 brothers, her uncle, her aunt. Their names, along with the others, are inscribed on the monument.
I want to thank the people that got it together and really thought about doing something like it. And I appreciate it. I think it's very nice.
You're not real nice.
It really is. Yes.
See, your relatives are rejoicing.
Yeah.
And after a little while, Artie Beatrice Cook Funkhauser and her lifelong Madison County friends sing for each other, and all their loved ones laid to rest. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Hallelujah, by and by. I'll fly away.
How was that, Paul?
That's good.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Joining us now is Katie Henriksen. Monday through Friday, she's the host of Note. And today, she is host of Sunday Symphony. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, fundraiser is over. The election has passed. Things are somewhat quiet.
Somewhat.
Somewhat, right. I mean, holidays are approaching, but do you give us something quiet tonight?
There's 2 symphonies tonight that I have planned. One from Henryk Gorecki, his symphony number 3, opus 36. It says, Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. It might be his most well-known work. And then another really actually well-known work, probably Dvorak's most listened to symphony. It's his symphony number 9 in E minor, From the New World. And about that subtitle, you know, we've talked before about how a lot of things get named, the composer doesn't make that name. Well, in this case, Dvorak did name it that because he wrote it when he was in the United States.
So From the New World.
So it was inspired by a lot of
by
things
coming
in,
to the New World.
In the United States, right, when he was here. So. Yeah.
The Gorecki, based on the title there, the subtitle, would indicate a quieter symphony. sorrow?
It's pretty tragic and sad and depressing, but beautiful. Okay. In a beautiful way.
Right. I understand.
So is the Dvorak, is it more upbeat because he's excited to be in America?
Dvorak's kind of known as a really lush, romantic composer, and this is very much in that style. It's really dramatic, and it's got a lot of flavors of the United States. I mean, he listened to folk music in the United States, and so it's kind of borrowing on music that he wasn't used to borrowing on because he was from Europe. So,
okay.
So two symphonies tonight.
And I might have time. I have a little bit of wiggle room, so if I find a shorter one, I might plug in a shorter one. Otherwise, I'll just find some other awesome music to put in there.
So it doesn't have to be a symphony.
It doesn't have to be.
Okay.
Sometimes the math just doesn't quite work out.
I got
There's
you.
Like 22 minutes left. I'm like, I can't find a symphony that's 22 right. minutes. So
I actually had that thought before we started this conversation, how you time that. So you answered a question I didn't vocalize.
You're psychic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Katie.
Thank
Tonight
you, guys.
At 7.
That's right.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Rhonda Bramall, Health Initiative Representative with the American Cancer Society. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Good. And you are joining me today because this Thursday, November 15th, is the Great American Smokeout.
That's right.
A day where people choose to quit smoking. Traditionally, it was to quit smoking for the day,
mm-hmm.
right? How did this get started?
Well, it's actually, this will be the 37th year. So this has been going on, 1976. Started in California, and that day in 1976, they've got records that they actually got 1 million people to stop smoking for the day. So a pretty big movement, I think. And then when they saw the impact, the American Cancer Society thought, okay, we can expand this and make this a national program. And they trademarked it. And, here it is 37 years later.
So were those 1 million people just in California, or was that nationally?
That was just California. The very first one they did was in California, kind of a test run, I guess. And when they saw the impact with 1 million people, then it kind of grew and spread across the country.
So it was just kind of like smoking is bad. Everybody just, they just
right
promoted that message.
Yes, and that's how it started out originally. And even, I can remember as a kid in school, we talked about the Great American Smokeout. It started out as we would ask people to quit for the day, and that was the commitment, which is to be quit for the day. But as things have progressed, and as we learn more about medicine and about our health and healthy habits and that sort of thing, we have kind of shifted the mentality into don't just quit for the day, but quit for good. And use the Great American Smokeout Day to be your quit day.
Today, mm-hmm. we can say, all right, looking forward to the 15th, okay, I'm going to quit on the 15th.
You bet. Because they have got studies that show people who plan to quit. And it's known that the majority of smokers do want to quit, and quitting is a difficult thing. So they've found that if you can have a target date and have a plan and be kind of psych yourself up, really, and be prepared that you're going to have more success to go ahead and quit.
Is there a safety in numbers kind of aspect to it, maybe a little bit too, that you're not alone?
You bet. I think anything you do where you need support, whether it's quitting smoking or being on a diet or just exercising, anytime you can do it with other people, I think it's good support and good motivation.
So you mentioned support. What does the American Cancer Society do to support people that want to quit?
Okay, great question. On our website is probably one of my favorite things that we have to offer, and I'll give you that address in a minute. But if you're interested in quitting, you can go there and you can download these little tools. One would be a desktop countdown clock for your calendar, for your computer. You can actually load this graphic onto your computer with a countdown to how many days until you quit. So you're mentally getting yourself prepared. Some other things that we have on the website is a they call it a crave button. So every time that you have a craving for a cigarette, you're supposed to click on the button, and it's just going to give you a reminder or give you a pep talk, I guess, for lack of a better word, just some encouragement. Every time you have a craving, you're going to read an encouraging message or a tip to stay quit. So it's pretty cool, and that can be found at cancer.org/smokeout. One word, smokeout.
So you mentioned that when you were in school, that they used to do events and stuff, and I remember this as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, as a fourth grader, you're not a smoker,
right?
So why promote this in elementary schools?
Well, before I had children, I wouldn't have been able to answer that question, but I have a 5-year-old now, and she will come home from school and nag us about what we're eating or what we're drinking or, hey, Mom, you need to go take a walk. You need to go exercise. We're supposed to exercise. So I think that message is really good to get to the kids because they're going to go home and share that with the parents. Obviously, we're not asking the children to quit smoking. It's a little bit different message with them. It's, we promise we won't smoke later. But there's value in going home and sharing that with the family and their parents. And lots of times, just having that 5-year-old look at you and say, Daddy, smoking is bad for you, or you're going to get sick, or smoking makes you stink. I think that, carries a lot of weight and has a lot of impact.
All right. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense.
Yes.
For sure. So do you know, statistics for, so I pick November 15th. I quit smoking for that day.
Mm-hmm.
What, how long until I'm a non-smoker?
I think, you quit. And you're quit. I mean, to me, that's cut and dry. I don't think there are really any statistics that say, but I can tell you that there are benefits to quitting smoking within 30 minutes of quitting. As far as your breathing and your coughing less and that sort of thing. And I also know that after 10 years of having quit, a person who has smoked has the same or has half the chance of getting lung cancer as someone who's still smoking. So you're cutting your chances in half of getting lung cancer. So to me, that's pretty powerful.
What else? It is powerful. What else does the American Cancer Society do? I mean, it's not just all about, the Great American Smokeout.
You're right. A lot of what we do is education. We go out and into the community where we get asked all the time to do programs and presentations. So we present healthy information on living healthy, but then our service aspect where we serve patients who do have cancer and their caregivers, we provide
just kind of in coping.
Yeah, in coping and supplies, like for women who have had their breasts removed, we provide the prosthetics and special bras that they need, all for free. We don't charge for any service. If a woman or man, in some cases, is going through treatment and they lose their hair, they can come to us and get a free wig. We can also try to connect them if they're having financial problems, having a hard time paying for their treatment or, you fall behind on your bills during your treatment. We can connect them. We don't necessarily give people money, but we can connect them with people that can help them. A couple of our big programs here locally, Look Good, Feel Better, is a very popular program, and that's where women who are in treatment can come to a session. It's facilitated by a cosmetologist. They get a makeup bag, free makeup for them to keep, and they just go over with them, teach them how to wear their makeup during their treatment. When they're having problems like losing their hair, losing their eyelashes, their eyebrows. Some people have skin trouble or acne during treatment. So they address all those things and kind of show them how to keep going and how to deal with it and come out, feeling better about it. So that's one of my favorite programs that
right.
we have.
Wouldn't you say that lung cancer, smoking, quitting smoking is probably like the number one thing that you can do to prevent cancer. There are a lot of cancers. Breast cancer, there's pretty much nothing you can do.
Right. Right, and you're exactly right. Tobacco is the most preventable cause of cancer, without a doubt, because that's something that you're choosing to participate in. So, you know, obviously not all lung cancer is caused by smoking, but 80% is. And then another thing that I should throw in here, too, is our 1-800 number that we have. It's a toll-free hotline, and you can actually call and talk to a trained specialist who can, we call it a quit coach, and they're basically going to coach you through the process of quitting. They will email you, they will chat with you online, they will call you and check on your progress. It's a really fantastic tool. It's just like having a counselor, really, and it's all free as well.
And maybe kind of like that crave button. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, fighting that urge, you can call.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And November 15th seems like a good day to do it.
You bet.
All right. Well, thank you, Rhonda.
Thanks for having me.
Rhonda Brammel is the Health Initiatives Representative for the Northwest Arkansas Office of the American Cancer Society. For more information on the Great American Smokeout, visit cancer.org/smokeout. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
The process of watching a movie at a theater is pretty simple. Buy your ticket, select your snack of choice, sit in the seat, and enjoy the story as it plays out in front of you on the big screen. Making a movie is anything but simple. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda takes us to a local movie set.
Okay. All right, everybody quiet on the set. We're going to go ahead and roll this with one of our cameras. This is so complicated, we're just going to shoot everything. All right? Quiet on the set. Roll sound.
Rolling.
Roll camera.
Scene 16A, take one, speed.
You can't speed, it's Mark.
Clear, be set. And action.
In September, the crew and cast of Gordon Family Tree were hard at work filming throughout Northwest Arkansas. On this overcast September day, the filming location is a home that's tucked away among the trees on West Pratt Drive in Fayetteville. Although it's located just a few minutes west of the hustle and bustle of the University of Arkansas campus, this home, which looks like an overgrown treehouse, feels like it's in the middle of the woods. Today, the owners have graciously given their home to the cast and crew of Gordon Family Tree, a project of Jenica and Ryan Schwartzman.
Jenica and I wrote it, and I grew up here, and my dad built this house. My dad's a builder here. He's a contractor building just custom homes, and which is one of the characters, is one of the main characters is based on him, a person in Arkansas who builds homes that the community knows and embraces. So we're using a lot of the homes that he built.
Ryan plays the lead in the film, which tells the story of a man who quits his job at an architecture firm and goes on a road trip he never took in college to really think about his future. One of the first things you notice being on a movie set is how many people there are. Between cast and crew, there are people everywhere working on hair, makeup, lighting, and cameras. With so many people working on such a large project, delegation is key.
Delegation's a big one, as well as making sure everyone just does their job, which is a big part of Mike Hill is our first AD, and his job on set as the first assistant director is to really make sure everyone is doing their job and their job alone. So making sure that the actors aren't moving equipment and making sure that the costume person isn't, you know, moving things, making sure that crew aren't moving props, because a lot of times when you're shooting in a location, you see just an empty cup or a couple flowers or a pillow even, and people just come up and think, oh, well, I should move this out of the way, but it's set there specifically for a reason.
For people that are new to a movie set, Ryan says one of the things they may notice is the use of some unique terminology.
There's a lot of odd things where things have different names that don't need different names. Like an extension cord is called a stinger. There's just odd terminology. A lot of times they use, like you'll see, there's clothespins on the lights that hold the gels and filters, and those are called C-47s. I can't tell you why, but it's what it is. And if someone is stepped away and they've gone to the restroom, then a lot of times they'll say, okay, where is so-and-so? And instead of saying they're in the bathroom and they're in the restroom, you say they're 10-1.
After spending just a little bit of time on set, it's easy to see that there is so much planning that must go into the project before filming can even begin. Ryan says some of the biggest details to attend to are scheduling and eating.
Food is a huge one that a lot of people forget about just because everybody needs to eat and you're thinking about, oh, we got to get all the equipment, we got to get the actors, but you have to feed people, just to keep them happy, to keep energy there. So fortunately we've got, that took a lot of doing, that Jenica did, getting local restaurants have sponsored all of our meals, which has been amazing, to get them on board and donating their food for our meals. And getting extras is a big thing. People who are willing to come out for free and, give their time and energy and be high energy. And then there's other little things, like when you're on set, you have to print stuff, but you don't always have a printer. So we now have to carry a printer, and we have to carry like a portable internet thing so we can upload things. And there's a lot of little things that we keep learning as well as, remembering we need to do.
Yes, it's true. Different shoots may require different things, but what is a typical day on set like?
A typical day is generally at least a 12-hour day. We, for example, this morning, the crew was called on set, so everyone had to be here at 8 a.m., so they have to, account for their travel here. And then we always have 6 hours, and then there's lunch. So you have 6 hours, so you get here and you have to start working right away, 6 hours and lunch, and then you also account for 6 hours after that is dinner. So it's very different from a lot of jobs where, like you said, 9 to 5, you show up, you take a lunch break, and then you go home. But here it's, you show up and you don't think about food. Someone else's job, like ours, to make sure you're fed lunch and then you're fed dinner. And then after dinner, you usually work for maybe an hour or two, and then you'll go home. And there are rules and regulations for union jobs, but we're trying to abide by those as much as possible, just because they're in place for a reason. Such as at the end of the day, there's what they call a 10-hour turnaround, meaning that when the entire crew gets wrapped or gets to where they're staying, there needs to be 10 hours between that time and when they are called to set. So that, a lot of times, is another scheduling thing we have to deal with, where we can say, okay, tomorrow we're going to start at 8 a.m., but if the night before we don't get home until midnight, then we have to start later the next day.
Helping keep track of the time is a job of the first assistant director, who is known as the AD for short. Ryan explains that the time allotted to shoot a scene is based on the length of a scene or a fraction of a page.
We get a call sheet every day saying this is what time and this is what we're starting with, and then we're starting with scene 22 and then going to scene 41, and each one is broken up into an eighth of a page. So this is 1/8 page, this is one page, and you kind of work it out to figure out about 5 pages a day is a lot to shoot. So you can base it on how much dialogue there is, and so there's a lot of thought and energy that goes into that. But on set, the first AD's job, and Mike Hill has been amazing to us, because he is just, talking to him, it's just like numbers are flying in his head that I don't understand. Because we'll say, okay, we have, the director will decide how many shots he wants for each scene, and then the director will say, or Mike Hill will say, okay, if you have that many shots, that means you need to move you have this many setups, you need to move the camera every 8 minutes. And he's on top of it. He's got his watch and he looks, and then he'll go and say, okay, well, you're behind schedule, so now in order to catch up, you need to move the camera to get everything else, you need to move it every 5 minutes. So his job on set is, unfortunately, a lot of times the first AD's job is to not be liked. But he's a great guy. We all love him. He's great. But you have to be okay to be forceful and tell people, this is what has to happen. You need to move. You need to, because he's watching the time.
All right, everybody, now have your attention, please. This is scene 16. I need you to take good, careful stock of where you are right now on scene 16, because things are about to get a little complicated. What we're going to have in here is a toast going on by Mr. Gordon. So naturally, we would all turn to face him. So even if you're facing
the AD's job can also involve giving directions to the actors on set. Today, Mike Hill is directing more than a dozen extras who are filling the kitchen and living room in preparation of filming a birthday party scene. Tucked away in a narrow hallway near the front door, Nicole McAleese is sitting in front of a screen with a binder in her lap. I'm later told this area is called Video Village and is where the director and some other crew members like Nicole, the script supervisor, will huddle around the screen and observe as scenes are filmed.
My job is to make sure that we can cut the scenes together and that the editor has an appropriate guidance system of how to find which scenes he wants next. Otherwise, you can hand him a roll of stuff, but it's all a mystery. So my job is to make sure that he can do his job.
Excellent. So how do you do that? Is there a certain way to take notes or something?
Yeah. I take down the camera roll and I take down what the slate has, and I also write down notes and I also make sure the hair's the same. if you cut back and forth between two people talking and bangs are on one side and bangs are on the other side, that's kind of a problem. I also help keep track of what we're shooting today and what needs to be shot.
What are you doing over there, Justin?
The phrase hurry up and wait is sometimes used to refer to the film industry because cast and crew rush to be ready and then have to wait on someone else to finish their job in order to proceed. For example, before the extras could be ushered into the room, they had to wait while a crew set up lighting. As Nicole sits by the monitor, several men in black shirts and jeans come check the screen before going back and making more adjustments to their lights. Part of their challenge today is making it appear like night, even though it is afternoon, albeit an overcast one. Nicole's brother-in-law, Ian, is one of the crew members moving light fixtures and placing different colored sheets on plastic over the tops of light bulbs.
I'm the gaffer, so the DP, the director of photography, is my boss, so he is in final call, final say of what everything looks for, but my job is to understand what light's going to do, and if he says, I want there to be a light in the background and have it slash down on this general area, I know what things to put in front of the light to shape it in order for it to do that.
Of course, before the actors can come onto set, they must be dressed, both the actors and the set. Darlene Hampson, Jenica's mother, spends most of the afternoon walking briskly back and forth despite wearing a large black medical boot. She says it's a prop that came in handy after spraining her ankle on set. She has several jobs and is in charge of wardrobe, props, and set dressing.
Set dressing is mainly what I do, and that's simply make the set ready for so whatever color scheme we're using, or turning the rolling pin to Mag's diner and making all the things that Mag's would need to go with her character, like her name tags and her apron and all the things that give her distinction, and turn that particular restaurant into the restaurant that we're talking about that would be on the side of the road in Flagstaff, Arizona.
In addition to all of the tangible items, patience is a must on a movie set, especially because a director may have actors recite their lines again.
As we get this party started, I'd like to say a quick little something.
And again.
As we get this party started, I'd like to say a quick little something.
And again.
As we get this party started, I'd like to say a quick something. Some of you may have heard this a time or two, but
in order to film a scene just the way he wants. Once the director does get what he wants and filming wraps on a project, writer and producer Ryan Schwartzman says the filmmaking process is not yet finished. The next step is all of the editing that happens in post-production.
Fortunately, our director really does a lot of the editing himself, which I think makes things go very smoothly because he sees what we're shooting. He has a visual idea of what he wants. So we are giving up probably 95% of control of editing to him, and then we will visit it throughout the process and look at it and watch, and if there's something that really jumps out at it that bothers us, then we'll let him know we want to tweak that. But for the most part, like I said, he's got about 95% or more control of, at that point, it's his movie. And that happens a lot with the writer, is you write it and then you have to let go, because the director will a lot of times do rewrites, just something that he thinks will work better, and that's, you just have to be okay with it and trust that we hired a director who has the same vision as we do.
Filming has wrapped, but you can keep up with the movie's post-production progress at GordonFamilyTreeTheMovie.com.
And all that we have, and all that we've been given. May all your todays be blessed.
Blessed.
Cut. Cut. We're in cut. Okay, we're going again.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that story for a daily edition of Ozarks earlier this week.
It is Sunday, November 11th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
She is.
I hope I was. I was on Friday.
You still are.
You know how much I love theater.
Yes, I do.
But it's one thing as an actor to know that the monologue you're performing came from a real letter, from a real soldier serving in a real war.
Not fiction.
In Afghanistan or Iraq. It's another thing completely when you've done a performance and a veteran in the audience stands up and says, I knew that soldier. Mm. I told her family she'd been killed in action.
Ah, oh, that happens.
This is a fascinating show on stage this afternoon only. They've been doing it for kids, but for the public, this afternoon only at the Walton Arts Center. It's called Letters Home. And it's by Chicago's Griffin Theater Company. They've taken real letters from soldiers, not just soldiers who were killed in action.
Right.
Most of them, according to Bill Mazzolia, who's the creator of it, actually did come home. And also some from families. And turned them into these dramatic monologues. And then gotten photos and video from Facebook pages and MySpace. So they have the real photos and the real video of these real soldiers.
So is that like playing behind the actors that are?
Yes.
Okay.
And it is apparently very affecting.
I imagine.
I talked to one of the actors. His name's Michael Bartz. And he said it hits home really hard when you realize you have a tremendous responsibility to these people. We're giving people a voice who no longer have one. It should be fascinating. It was inspired by the New York Times op-ed article, The Things They Wrote, and the HBO documentary, Last Letters Home.
And that's this afternoon only.
This afternoon only at the Walton Arts Center at 2 o'clock. Tickets are $16 to $26. But if you are active or retired service, you can call the box office before the show at 443-5600 and get a $5 ticket.
Good.
Also this afternoon, because it's another busy day in the Ozarks, Arkansas Landscapes 2, a slideshow with Tim Ernst. Mm-hmm. 2 o'clock at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale. That's free. Up Among the Hills, a showing of the new documentary about Fayetteville by Larry Foley at 2 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library. Also free. There's a Veterans Day parade at 2:30 on Emma Avenue in Springdale.
Yes, there is. That's absolutely free.
Free.
The Ozark Mountains British Brass Band is performing a Veterans Day concert at 3 o'clock at Old High Middle School in Bentonville. It's just $8.
Practically free.
That's pretty close to free. A Veterans Day concert with Jonathan Story, Carrie Johnston, handbell choirs, 4 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Springdale. Also free. There you go.
That's a wide array of options.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Barton Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. It is Veterans Day. And later this afternoon, Christina, there will be a Veterans Day parade along Emma Avenue in Springdale.
There will be. Becca just told us about it, didn't she?
She did. And Steve Gray, who is the president of the Northwest Arkansas Veterans Day Association, as well as the military liaison for Senator John Bozeman's office, talked to me Friday morning about the parade.
Years past, it was the parade of the year. I mean, really, we didn't have Christmas parades and we didn't have other parades for various entities or efforts. And it really was our big parade of the year. And over the time, it's just sort of lost its significance. So actually, back in 1999, the Lions Club, who puts up a lot of the flags in the on the businesses on every national holiday, decided to orchestrate a parade. We had a parade in the area for years. And I was a part of that Lions Club back then. And then the next year, they decided to sort of not get involved. So that's when we created this Northwest Arkansas Veterans Day Association and been putting on parades since. What's interesting is we could get a lot of folks in the parade, but not a lot of folks to sit on the sidelines to say thank you. So we took a hiatus a couple of years back, and we're shamed into getting back at this because of a young lady by the name of Crystal Osborne. Her two children are named Justice and Liberty, by the way. And she put on a parade 2 years ago in Fayetteville with about maybe 15 or so entrants, 20 entrants. And we said, all right, we need to do this, and we don't care who's on the sidelines or not. So
I love the simple approach to if you want to be in, come.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is about recognizing our win. In fact, we're going to have 7 World War II veterans as our grand marshals, 5 male and 2 female. And we always get great support out of our car clubs in the area, the British Club, Thunderbirds, Corvette clubs. And we'll pile those folks in, and they'll be the first ones out to be recognized. We're going to have a little blurb on every single entity in the parade. We're going to have a little narrative so we can brag about them. We're going to have a couple of junior high school bands. Highlander Bagpipers always add a lot. And then we're going to have some of our assisted living folks from Butterfield and Arkansas, anybody else who can muster up some of our older veterans and put them in a bus and bring them out. It should be just a great day. We're praying for good weather. I understand there are going to be some clouds in the area, but unfortunately, last time we did it at Springdale, it did rain before the parade, so I hope that's not the jinx this year. But
we've talked about the parade, but I do want to ask you about you're on the road. You're between Jasper and Harrison, and some of the reason you're on the road, you've been meeting with some veterans today.
Well, we have. I try to get out to our veteran service officers. There are 75 counties, and I try to visit with them. And in my other capacity as the military liaison for the Senate, I try to do that as much as I can. I think it's important to keep that network going and for them to understand that we're wanting to tackle a lot of the different issues. And I went by a nursing home that we had presented medals to a couple of years ago, one of the veterans there, and I thought, doggone, I'm going to go in there and see how many are still around and give them a pat on the back. And most of them, one guy's 99 years old. In fact, we presented him a Bronze Star medal out of Coal Hill about 10 years ago. And he fought in the Philippines and liberated a prison camp. And as he turned the corner, he saw his older brother there, one that the whole family thought had perished. And it was just really quite a story. And so it was a kick. It was really enjoyable to recognize these folks. You know, they didn't ask for an awful lot, and they donned the uniform and fought for our freedom. And I think it's only right to give them some recognition.
All right, the parade, absolutely free, is Sunday afternoon along Emma in Springdale. Festivities begin at 1:30. Steve, please drive carefully, and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Kyle. Take care.
Steve Gray is the president of the Northwest Arkansas Veterans Day Association. He's also the military liaison for Senator John Bozeman's office. I talked to him Friday morning. He was in between Harrison and Jasper. He pulled over on Highway 7. Support for KUAF comes from Walton Art Center and the 10x10 art series featuring Eileen Ivers and Immigrant Soul Thursday. Grammy Award winner Eileen Ivers is a 9-time All-Ireland Fiddle champion and has performed with the London Symphony Orchestra, Boston Pops, Sting, Hall & Oates, and others. Tickets and more information at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600.
Support also comes from Theater Squared's annual Gala for Education, presenting the 2012 Arts Advocate Award to Denise and Hershey Garner. It will take place Thursday, November 15th at 6:30 p.m. The event, co-chaired by Lucy Arnaz and Lawrence Luckinbill, will benefit the theater's annual outreach to over 10,000 students and teachers. Tickets and more information can be found at theater2.org or by calling 445-6333.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Fort Chaffee.
Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Happy Sunday.